The Patrick administration set a goal of 2,000 megawatts of wind power capacity by 2020. That would be enough to power 800,000 homes, or 10% of the state's electricity load. With that in mind, many communities across the Commonwealth are considering wind turbine proposals. Last year, the town of Falmouth installed a turbine that neighbors say has disrupted their lives. This week, WCAI is airing a five-part series, The Falmouth Experience, The Trouble with One Town's Turbine. That trouble is impacting other projects and could affect Governor Patrick's pro-wind agenda. Joining us today to talk about this is Sean Corcoran, WCAI senior reporter. Morning, Sean.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Heather Goldstone, WCAI science editor and Climatide blogger. Hello, Heather.
Good morning, Mindy.
Well, as you drive into Falmouth, you see three large turbines. If you come farther, you see four, the one at the Mass Maritime Academy as well. But two are owned by the town that are at the wastewater treatment plant, and the third is a privately owned turbine at the industrial park. So Wind 1, Wind 2 are the town owned ones, and Wind 2 is not online yet.
Not yet. Later this spring.
All right. So tell us about what's happening here. Initially, when these turbines went up, they were welcome. People thought, oh, this is a great thing.
It was a 10-year discussion before turbines actually came to Falmouth. And the protracted discussion wasn't because there was opposition. It was not significant opposition. There were a few folks who had some questions. But it was because financially it didn't make a lot of sense for the town to get involved in buying wind turbines. So there had to be changes made to the law and to the way utilities purchase excess power from such turbines. So once that happened, once Deval Patrick came into office in 2007, Green Communities Act kind of changed things. And now you have municipalities looking at turbines not only as a way to improve their carbon footprint, but also as a way to cut down on the amount of money they spend on electricity. And extra power can be sold back to the utility at a good rate. What that rate is right now is a little uncertain. It's around 15 cents per kilowatt hour, mm-hmm. I believe.
And now we have two different processes here. We have the private turbine that went through a special permit, correct, Heather?
Yes.
So there was a whole different process for that than with the town turbines.
Yeah, the town turbines, and Sean can speak to this more, but the town turbines, because they were municipally owned, were exempted from the special permitting process for wind turbines.
Right. So tell us what folks, I know there was one in one of your stories, Sean, one of the neighbors there, he had been in the green and solar panel business, and he was saying, this is great, bring it on. And then the turbine went on and he started to have some issues. So what are people saying? What's happening?
Well, it's not all neighbors. We should make that clear. And I think we do make that clear in the series. It's some neighbors, and estimates run up to perhaps 50 people. We do know that 12 families have signed on to a lawsuit. So that's 12 families who have put up a couple thousand dollars each to get an attorney. So that we can kind of extrapolate from there a little bit. So they're talking, people who are affected are talking about insomnia, teeth grinding, headaches, depression, ringing in their ears. People compare it to seasickness. Some people get it, some people don't. And people get it to kind of different degrees. They're affected to different degrees. That's what we're hearing from some neighbors.
And are they saying this is from the sound of the wind turbines?
They believe it's from the sound. And there's three different sounds that people are describing. And Heather's really the mm-hmm. expert on the sound here. She's really looked into sound here. But they're talking about the swoosh, swoosh, the regular sound that comes as the blades spin. Then there's also another sound they talk about, which is more irregular sound. It's like a sneaker in a dryer. That's how it was explained to me. And then there's this third sound, the real controversial sound, and that's called infrasound. And that sound that is at a lower decibel level?
It's actually at a lower frequency. It's very low frequency sound. And calling it infrasound, actually, even sort of defining what we're talking about there is a little hard, because the official definition for infrasound is anything with a frequency less than 16 hertz. It commonly gets sort of rounded up to 20 hertz. But that cutoff for calling it infrasound, which is supposed to mean that it's noise vibrations that are below the level where the human ear can hear it, is actually set according to what 50% of people can hear. So 50% of people can actually hear a little bit below that frequency cutoff, can hear into that very low frequency range. And obviously, as the volume in that range goes up, the number of people who can hear it and the amount they can hear goes up. And actually, in that very low frequency range, responses to it, the ability to hear it and responses to it, considering it annoying or disruptive, increase more rapidly than they do at higher frequencies that we tend to hear. So there's something kind of more disturbing about that low frequency range, it would appear. And there's also something with this the swooshing sound. We know that what are called impulse sounds, these more of a thumping as opposed to a constant white noise, is harder for people to get used to and kind of block out. And one or two studies have looked at the nature of wind turbine sound. A lot of scientists say there's nothing unique about wind turbine sound, but a couple of studies have specifically looked at how people react, their reactions to this type of sound, and find that it is significantly more disruptive to people. People call it more annoying or more disturbing at much lower volume levels than, say, airport noise or highway noise or a lot of other industrial or traffic noise. So
that's interesting.
Right. And it's a tough discussion, because as communities take a look at wind turbines, they're hearing about this infrasound that they don't know much about. And the science, as Heather looked at the different studies that have been done, there's not a lot of science there. So you have folks who are standing in front of you giving testimony as to how they're affected by something. Then you have people on the other side standing up and saying, well, hold on, there's not the science to support that this is why you feel that you have symptoms.
We're talking about land-based wind turbines in our series on the Falmouth turbines. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Heather, so let's talk about the science in this for a second. Do we have any peer-reviewed, and talk about the importance of peer-reviewed studies versus other studies.
Right. What we have, I would say, sort of falls into three categories. We have peer-reviewed literature. Peer-reviewed science is in science when a study is completed, the scientists write up a paper describing what they've done, and they submit it to a journal, which then sends it out to a number of other scientists to review it, to judge it based on its merits, and say, okay, this looks like it was done right. You know, it was interpreted well. Go ahead and publish it. So it's kind of a quality control system within the scientific community, and that's very important to scientists to see that the results have been peer-reviewed. So in terms of peer-reviewed science, what we have is a very broad understanding of sound and of hearing. But in terms of, and that doesn't necessarily suggest that there would be any problems, but in terms of science directly addressing wind turbines, we have much less in the peer-reviewed realm. In really, honestly, directly looking at this question, maybe a dozen different studies. So it's really not much. What is out there and is very suggestive is a lot of studies conducted either by municipalities, by local governments, or by independent groups where they've gone and done surveys. And they do tend to turn up the same answer, which is that people around the world, when they're living in very close proximity, and we're talking here, you know, quarter mile, half mile of a large wind turbine or multiple large wind turbines, are turning up these same complaints. But as I said, the peer-reviewed science to figure out why, what the origin of these complaints really is, how the sound creates that, is much less clear because, you know, as I said, based on our sort of broad understanding, this wasn't necessarily expected.
So is there somebody looking at that now? I mean, now that we've got all these complaints, are we having people who are specifically
a few people. Looking at this? Yeah, a few people. And there's one scientist actually out at Washington University in St. Louis who's really pushing on the issue of infrasound and saying that he studies hearing and says that based on his own work, there is evidence that the ear does respond to sound that is too low frequency to actually be heard. So he's suggesting that it's a I'd say a vocal minority opinion at this point. But and then there is actually a doctor up in Maine, Dr. Michael Nissenbaum, who his study is not yet published. It has been conditionally accepted for publication, but he has actually done. We'll have to wait and see, but appears to be a well-controlled survey of people living at various distances from two different wind installations in the state of Maine.
And Heather interviewed Dr. Nissenbaum, and I believe you're going to have that interview on Climate Time.
Yep, I'll be actually putting an extended transcript of my interview with Dr. Nissenbaum. Very interesting, and you know, he says he thinks that what's going on is that this kind of swooshing noise and possibly the infrasound, but some aspect of the noise is waking people up at night, which is obviously a complaint many people have, is their sleep disturbance is one of the main complaints. And he thinks that's really at the heart of the problem, that prolonged sleep disturbance has known medical effects, and that the symptoms people are talking about, the headaches, the irritability, the depression, are all things that we know happen with prolonged sleep deprivation.
Let's talk to Preston, who's giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Preston.
Hi, how are you? Good morning. I want to thank you for the series that you've been running, you're running this week. And like Mindy said earlier, I think it's so important because, as you know, the federal and state governments have set that goal of 2020, which is 20% energy coming from renewables. So in our state, the government, the governor's targeted the Cape and Island South Coast for hundreds of these onshore, near offshore industrial wind turbines. So I think we all need to be aware to understand the risk, the human health, the environment, historic values, tourism, and property values. And I know you're focusing on Falmouth and the experience of the Falmouth residents, but like Heather said a few moments ago, I've seen studies and actually talk with victims living near, within really 3 to 4 to 5 kilometers of wind turbines in different parts of the world. And, and my question is, they all report the same set of symptoms, almost using the same words. And I guess I ask both Sean and Heather, what is your sense of it, that what they all say is that when they leave the immediate area where the turbines are in operation, in other words, where they're living, and they leave, the symptoms essentially disappear. And then when they return back to their homes, the symptoms reappear.
Yeah, Preston, that's a good question. And these are coming, as we mentioned, not only from the folks here in Falmouth, but people who live near large turbines in New Zealand, Europe, Australia. So there is this sort of commonality in what people are saying, and I don't think there's anybody saying this isn't happening to them, right? People are accepting this is there is something real happening to these people.
Well, there are three reactions that you tend to get from folks who are pro-wind or aren't certain how they feel. They hear from these folks in Falmouth, and they say, yeah, there's the ring of truth here. Something, there's no motivation for them to be making this up. Something is wrong, and they kind of accept that. The next is totally dismissive of them and say, well, we need wind. These are either casualties of the wind push, or they're really up to something else, and we can dismiss their complaints. And the third that we hear is kind of a distancing from Falmouth turbine. Some pro-wind folks are saying, no, something is happening in Falmouth, but it's an anomaly. That's an older turbine technology. It was in storage for several years in Texas. They don't make it anymore. So maybe something's happening with that particular turbine, but other proposals should be okay. So that's the type of reaction that you get. Because this is not a happy story for anybody.
No, for anybody, right.
Yeah, and the sense I get, you know, I have not, I will not even claim to have exhaustively looked at all the different wind turbine installations around the country or around the world, but the sense I get from the surveys that have looked at people at different distances is that it really comes down to how close people are. And yes, if you install a wind turbine and there's nobody living within maybe even half a mile, you might be okay. If there's nobody within a mile, you're probably okay. It's these cases where people are living within a quarter of a mile, a third of a mile, a half a mile, these really close proximities where you tend to get this real surge of people complaining.
And that comes to question, what is the proper distance? We don't really know the answer to that, do we?
No,
we really don't know that. Yeah. We really don't know that. And, you know, I think some people would argue that it needs to not necessarily be a set distance. It needs to be a sound level. But then in the case of Falmouth, the wind turbine actually, even at those residences that are closest, conforms to existing state and town guidelines. It doesn't go above 40 decibels.
But infrasound is low.
But the complaint here is that there is something about wind turbine. The counterargument is that there's something about wind turbine noise that is not the same as all other noises and is more disturbing at lower decibel levels. And so maybe the existing framework for noise regulations, you know, is not appropriate for wind turbines.
And that's what we're hearing. That might change. There might be some regulation changes based on what's happening in Falmouth. I mean, right now, there's a recommended bylaw by the state which is saying have a setback of, I think it's, 1.5 times the height of the top of the blades. So that'd be 1,000 feet if you have a 400-foot turbine. Well, is that sufficient? Judging from Falmouth, maybe not. But it depends where you're talking about. You can go to Hull. Everyone likes to talk about Hull, and Hull seems to be its success when it comes to the two 1.8 megawatt turbines, which are comparable to what is in Falmouth. And there are very few complaints there. There are a few, but very few complaints. But Hull is also in a different place than West Falmouth. I mean, it's right near one of the main runways for Logan Airport. You have the ocean there. You have highway traffic there. So the ambient sound is naturally at a higher level than what you have here in Falmouth.
All right. Let's talk to Lily, who's calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Lily.
Hi. And again, thank you to all of you, Mindy, and also to Sean and Heather, for your attention to this very serious question. We have spoken to Sean, and Preston and I have just returned from a trip to Australia and New Zealand, where we did have the honor to interview approximately 25 people from three different areas who are adversely impacted from a health standpoint. That means that they have the physical symptoms that they did not experience prior to the wind turbine going live. And we also had the honor of interviewing experts who have been studying the impact of wind turbines on humans, including the PhDs of Bob Thorne, Daniel Shepard, Hoop Baker, and the medical doctor, Sarah Laurie, as well as Bruce Rapley, who's been studying it as well. And what we found is that the people we interviewed and the experts said that the wind turbines conclusively do cause these adverse health effects, and the experts say that they're finding it adverse impacts 5 kilometers and 10 kilometers away. So, I mean, it's much farther than what we seem to be saying here on the program today. And my question is, why can't we stop this now? Put a moratorium in place and study these issues before we put more people at risk and cause more harm and human suffering.
Right. Look, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I want to point out one thing that Sean already touched on, which is that there are a couple of studies looking at just how far sound propagates in different sorts of environments, and everything from the types of rocks, the geology, the types of rocks that are under the ground, whether you've got hilly or flat ground, what kinds of trees you have, whether you're in an urban or a rural setting. All of these things, this whole environment influences how far the sound goes, and also how strongly negative people's reactions to that sound are. So it's not just I think in part, you know, the idea that we could just set a distance for everywhere may or may not work because it's a very complex problem.
Well, in a sense, there is sort of a moratorium in a way, because this is impacting other projects that, you know, people that think maybe like look at the Brewster situation and Bourne, right. Like all these projects that seem to sort of maybe be moving forward have now all come to a screeching halt.
There's really been a sea change in how people feel about wind and wind projects here on Cape Cod. It seemed to me that Cape Wind, when it was first proposed, really generated a lot of interest in land-based wind turbines as that offshore debate was going on and turbine proposals were moving forward happily. But since Falmouth, boards such as Brewster, a couple projects in Bourne, Dennis, that are still being worked out, you know, they're being faced with this tough decision of what do I do with these? I got these folks in front of me who say they're sick. I've got very kind of foggy standards that I might apply here. I'm not sure what to do. And it's kind of holding projects up. They're not necessarily being rejected outright, but they are being held up. And then sometimes they're going to the courts and being removed from the community. So the state would say, pro-wind folks would say, we need a siting board at the state level who can really decide where is the proper place to site these turbines based on everything that happens in that area.
And of course, in the Falmouth situation, there, you know, wind one is up and operating. Wind two is up and ready to start operating. Selectmen decided last week to turn off wind one when it reaches wind speeds of 23 miles per hour. And I want to make a correction here. On Friday in the news roundup, Laura Rickford mentioned that would cost $30,000 a month. She meant to say a year. But her point was that there may be implications of the shutdown that we haven't seen yet. She mentioned maybe it could impact the lawsuits. How does it impact the warranty? The fact that the town attorney and the acting town manager advised them not to bring up this issue. It wasn't on the agenda, and the selectmen decided to do it. So there's a lot of what-ifs
here. There's a lot of government machinations going on right now. I mean, the whole the turbines themselves are in controversy because there was no special permit process. Now, this recommended bylaw by the state that towns should adopt if they're going to do turbines, that recommends a special permit process for every turbine. But in Falmouth, there was a decision made that, no, it's town use. It doesn't have to go through that process. It's what's happening at the government level is kind of complicated and in terms of open meeting violations. Right. So I don't see that getting sorted out all too quickly. But the, shutting it off, yes, it will cut into the profits or cut into the amount of savings that the town of Falmouth expects to receive. But this, that happens with turbines. Mm-hmm. This idea of flicker, which is a shadow cast as the sun is behind the moving blades, that commonly leads to mitigation efforts where you shut it down for a certain amount of time in order not to adversely affect neighbors who are trying to have their breakfast or whatever's happening at that time. And that cuts into the expected savings. But that is kind of part of the process right now. Is that right, Heather?
Yeah. I mean, I think we've got a really tricky issue here with the, as Sean said, all the competing political issues and whether there is actually room on Cape Cod to put these things, whether there's adequate room to actually be putting these in such a densely populated area. And yet, with the conflicting need to try to get more renewable power into our portfolio. So it's a
tough situation. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you talk to the state and they say Cape Cod is crucial to this 2000 megawatts by 2020. But here on Cape Cod, they're not moving forward. So what does that mean for this overall goal?
Yeah. All right. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Heather, talk about policy. Policymakers generally, we're talking about, the peer-reviewed science, and we don't have a lot of it. We have people studying it now. But when it comes to setting policy, policymakers generally, they want proof of what's got there. They can see this is happening. We can see people are sick, but they have to know what's causing it to really impact policy, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is that at least is the precedent that has been set with, say, chemical pollution and the health impacts of pollution, that lawmakers generally have been very reticent to act until there is a really clear chain of blame, basically, that you can really lay this out step by step. Here is, in this case, the noise. Here's how it interacts with the human body. Here's how it causes a health impact. And here's the health impact and how frequently it happens in the population. Having that whole chain there, at least in sort of the history of chemical pollution, that's been really key to actually getting government action to mitigate it. But it's also very interesting because in that history, there's been a large push from the environmental movement and from concerned citizens to adopt what's called the precautionary principle, which is basically to say that if we have reason to suspect that there is a problem, then the burden of proof should be shifted to those claiming that there's no problem, and we should act in a precautionary way. Now, that hasn't necessarily been the history of the United States in terms of lawmaking to act on the precautionary principle, but I think we've got sort of a parallel thing going here where we don't have that complete chain in the peer-reviewed science. We don't have it nailed down, but I think we are accumulating this body of evidence that at least gets us to that level of saying, we suspect that there's something going on here.
All right. Josh in Wellfleet. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, Josh.
I wanted to just add a bit of color to this discussion because I used to work for a large-scale wind farm construction company that had a very wide geographic footprint. And constructed wind farms in very high population density areas. And one of the issues that we consistently ran into when we were developing wind farms was that whenever a wind farm was proposed, there was always 5 to 10% of the local population that was very heavily against the concept of a wind farm. Usually widespread agreement and support, but then a vocal minority that was against the project for various reasons. And then once our wind farms were operating, the correlation between the local residents who experienced problems with wind turbine noise correlated very, very closely to the same residents that were against the wind project before construction even began. Mm-hmm. So I completely agree that the science is not even close to done in terms of evaluating where we are and what the true impacts of wind turbine noise may be. I think that any study that examines the issue really has to take into account whether there is a psychosomatic effect that is happening between essentially belief that you're going to experience problems from the wind farm mm-hmm. and then having those problems materialize once the problem goes up, once the operational.
Yeah, Josh, thanks. Those are good points.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And there is actually a little bit of science that has started to address that. A couple of studies in Europe. And it's absolutely true. If someone has a negative attitude towards the wind turbines, whether it's that they don't like the visual impact or that they just don't like wind turbines for whatever reason, then absolutely, in the few studies that have been done, there's a very strong correlation between that negative attitude and a higher predisposition towards feeling, reporting these health impacts. But that said, that doesn't explain everybody.
Right.
Okay, so there seems to also be a portion of the population that experiences these impacts mm-hmm. regardless of their attitude towards wind turbines. And that's where I think we've got right. this issue.
Because
that needs
some
to be
of the
out.
Folks in Falmouth were for this. And you know,
that's
we're
my
not
understanding.
Yeah,
very
we're not
very
yeah.
few people right. were expressing concerns in advance. And one, Barry Funfar, who was in today's story, he was concerned before it went up. Then he went to Hull, didn't hear anything, mm-hmm. and he said he wasn't concerned anymore.
Right. Let's talk to Denise in Brewster. Hi, Denise.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I'm concerned about what the state has for mandates regarding how much energy should come from renewable sources. Typically, I grew up in Worcester, and now I live here in Cape Cod. And typically, Boston wants to sort of push off all the responsibility onto everyone but the people in Boston. So I'm kind of wondering, what are Boston's goals for what they can do in their city to help with all of this? Yeah. They're probably not going to get turbines, but are there mandates for new buildings going up to have solar panels? What are they doing to help all of this?
It's a good question, Denise. Do we know the answer to that, Sean?
As far as I know, there's individual communities or a city such as Boston doesn't have any particular goal, but you do raise a good point. I think what really is happening now is that much of these 2,000 megawatts will probably have to come from offshore, and I think that's the plan going forward, to try to get more of these turbines offshore rather than face all these siting issues onshore. Mm-hmm. Of course, here on Cape Cod, we know how that has worked with the Cape Wind project, right. but which is now apparently right. moving forward.
Well, and I would say, I'm not going to try to get into details because I don't remember them all, but I read a few weeks ago Governor Patrick's clean energy and conservation plan for the state, and it does include, I think, actually the largest proportion of cuts in the state's carbon footprint are expected to come from more efficient buildings. Mm-hmm. So definitely looking at building efficiency as part of it, not just changing our energy generation
right.
portfolio.
And sorry for the phone calls we couldn't get to. Well, I think we may have to do another program on this, and maybe in a couple of weeks, and get some more folks involved in the conversation. The series is running the rest of the week. You can find it on our website. You can also go to Climatide and read Heather's blogs, and we've got lots of comments from folks that have been listening so far to the couple we've had. Heather Goldstone is our science editor, and Sean Corcoran is our senior reporter. Thank you both.
Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is broadcast weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.